Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thank you for listening to this podcast of Real Recovery. There are many more podcasts available at myfaithradio.com. Your support makes this possible. Thank you. Welcome to Real Recovery. So glad you're joining us tonight. Bill Arnold on this side of the studio and just across the way, a man who knows the entire Oscar Mayer Wiener song by heart, George P. Fraser. Hello, George.
I kind of do.
No, I know you do. Don't pretend you don't.
Okay, do you know Big Mac, two all-beef fatty special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, onions, and a sesame seed bun? Isn't that right?
Yeah, it is right, but I could probably say it better than that.
Yeah, I kind of slurred there.
But
I am sober, though.
I know, but the Oscar Mayer Wiener song is impressive that you know that by heart. And I don't want you to sing it right now because that would eat up time that we don't have.
Yeah.
Because we've got a very special guest tonight in studio, and we want to make sure we take full advantage of our time.
I think one of our favorites of all time.
And
we're bringing him back. He was on a few years ago, and now it's going to be TR 2.0.
I love that.
Because we want to hear what God has done in his life the last few years, and it's remarkable.
Yeah. So let's jump into a step, because we always do that on Real Recovery. We like to put a step into the show every episode, and today I think we're going to talk about step number one, George.
Tonight.
Today, or this afternoon.
Yeah, step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, drugs, and our life was unmanageable. And really, if God is sovereign, and he is, he allows everything that happens, we control nothing. Our next breath comes at the mercy of an all-sovereign God. And so, Bill, when we work with guys, a lot of times they'll say, you know, I'm a pretty good guy, except for my drinking and drug use. And, you know, I get that out of the way and I'll be good. And what you realize when you stop doing that, there's a reason you drank. And a lot of us, it's self-centered and egocentrism. What's in this for me? I want to do what I want. I'll call on God when I need him, but I can take it from here.
Mm-hmm. George, what about if I had a surgical procedure done and all of a sudden I got some pain pills and I liked them? Then what?
Well, of course you're going to like them. And you can't tell if they're medically prescribed or if you got them on the street. I think a lot of people that are addicts have a larger pleasure center in their brain. They like them more.
Mm-hmm.
And usually the people we work with are all in guys. There's no off button. And when they like something, when can I do it again?
Mm-hmm.
But you always have to watch those because you will like them. They light up the pleasure center in your brain.
Mm-hmm.
And once you learn the feeling, you seek the feeling, and the addiction process is underway.
Okay, George, let's talk about step number one. Give us some coaching and teaching on step one.
Well, for me, really what it gets down to, I go to John 15:5. Jesus said, apart from me, you can do nothing. And our next breath does come at the mercy of an all-sovereign God. So we aren't in charge of anything. And when we work with guys, we ask them, what do you control? Well, I control my business and my family, and everybody's one serious accident, one serious illness, one major market correction away till you realize you're at God's mercy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the greatest benefits that happen to people is to learn that. But a lot of times it's people that have had great success in their life that get addicted. And then they have to look at their whole life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think tonight we're going to hear a little bit about that because our guest did have a lot of success at many different levels. And then it came time to change.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to do step one because that's his favorite step. And I think for me, looking back, I had said many times, I love the program. It's just step one I don't like. I want to keep drinking.
Mm-hmm. Well, George, talk about the importance of working with people. And tonight is an occasion where you're happen to be working with our guest.
Can I
say that? Is that cool?
Absolutely.
If I can't, we're in trouble.
No, we walk alongside people is the way I was taught how to do it. And you don't lord over somebody, but you walk alongside. And what you find is, for me, the guys I work with, I get more from them than they'll ever get from me.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also something it talks about in the Blue Recovery book in a chapter called Working with Others, that intensive research has shown that the greatest way to show immunity against that first drink is extensive work with other people. And I thought the first time I read that, well, you know, that makes sense because you see what happens to guys who go back to drinking, that's going to be bad. No, what happens is when you quit and you go through the steps, and step 12 says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. You do the steps, God enters your heart, and you have a heart change. Mm-hmm. And the reason people keep drinking is because they want to. But the heart change from the Holy Spirit, he convicts you of how bad you're doing, but also offers you hope. And I know for me, when I got a one-year medallion after 7 years of in-and-out failure of circling the drain, a couple weeks later, a guy in my group got his, and I felt almost as good for him as I did for me. Mm-hmm. And I thought, what's next? Am I going to shave my head and, you know, sell flowers at the airport? But something had happened.
I would actually like to see that.
Yeah, well, I could make some good money. And what happened is you start caring for other people. And the guys I work with, the guys who don't make it, the guys who do, I love these guys.
Mm-hmm.
And that sounds really hokey, but
no,
it's true.
No, it doesn't sound hokey
at
all.
And Tom's become a very good friend like you.
Mm-hmm.
You've helped me with my recovery, even though you're not alcoholic or addict, but you've helped my walk. And you want to be part of this. And I always tell guys, I want you to meet my friends because I don't want you to miss this.
How come you've never introduced me to anybody?
I said my friends. No, I haven't. You know, you work with a lot of my friends.
Yeah, that's true.
And I don't know, for me, that's the greatest part of recovery. It's not that seeing how bad it is for guys. It's this is a lot bigger thing and God touches us.
Yeah. All right. How about the question of when a person has a relapse and you are talking to them, one of the first questions you ask is, at the point of relapse, how many men were you working with?
Can I back that up a little bit?
Oh, please, of course.
Yeah, and now the term relapse, I think, is misused a lot.
Okay.
I do it all the time myself. Really, what relapse is the process by which we return to chemical use. And the reason that's important is I can identify it and change it. I don't need to have it happen. And I think we're most of the time daily in a relapse process. Whenever we get away from God, we need to repent and turn around and walk back to him. But the end result is using. And I always ask guys, and we get this from our friend Glenn R.,
mm-hmm.
how many guys were you working with? Now, that doesn't mean direct sponsorship or mentorship. Like our guest tonight, some people finance stuff. Some people spend time volunteering. Some people invest. I know Tom gets a lot of people jobs. You know, don't bother getting me one because I don't want one. But that's an important thing, too. And I think the business people...
You're unemployable, George.
I am.
Just as an aside.
I'm unemployable.
Leave it at that.
But I think the underserved part of the Christian ministry are businessmen that pay for the lights.
Mm-hmm.
They pay for the salaries, and they get people jobs. And this is one of those guys.
Yeah, fantastic. So but there is something about working with men that is critical for recovery.
Well, what we say on this program is God doesn't get you saved and sober without having a job for you to do. And you realize no matter how badly you mess up, he'll save you if you let him, and he will help you get sober because he has a job for you to do. You can connect that person to God because you've walked the walk he has.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to hear a lot about that tonight.
Yeah. George, before we leave step one tonight, is that the hardest step? Step one?
Yeah, but it's
the
essential. Now, I look at the steps as not linear, but circular.
Okay.
What do I mean? Let's say I'm doing an inventory and say, okay, I don't do this, but let's say I make smart, funny comments that offend people. And I realize that just because they're funny, that doesn't make it okay. And
right.
God works on my heart and says, you're not okay with offending people. And I go, I'm not. And he goes, no, you're not. So I work to change. That would be step 10. And then I have to go to step 1 and go, God, I'm powerless without you to change this.
Mm-hmm.
Give me the power, strength, and desire. And that's how step one works in a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have kids and they're using, you're powerless over that. And you have to say, God, I'm powerless over that. You work step one with, I think, every change you make.
Mm-hmm.
But the great miracle isn't that we're sober. It's that we're happy about it. And that starts with step one.
Mm, I like that. All right, Georgia boy, let's take a little break. When we come back, we're going to bring on our very, very special guest, Tom. And I can't wait for this to start because we're going to have a great time. We'll be right back. You're listening to Real Recovery with Bill and George. Ryan's on the board. If you have any questions about how to find us, you can go to myfaithradio.com. Check out the Real Recovery show page. You can see an 11-year-old picture of George and I. And I'm on the left. George is on the right. And you can make any kind of comment you like about that photo.
I'll make a comment. It looks like you're auditioning for Star Trek in your own orange shirt there.
Okay, that probably is making people curious, George, to go check it out. So
yes.
Thank you for that.
Sorry.
I really appreciate that. Anyway, we'll be right back with Tom in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. George, this gets to be the favorite part of the show for me, where we talk less and our guest talks more.
Yep.
That's my favorite part.
This will be great.
Yeah.
This is going to be, we could go get something to eat after you ask him a question.
Well, because we both could properly introduce our guest, I'm going to give you the honors to get things started, George.
Well, our guest is our friend Tommy. And Tommy did the show several years ago. And stunner. God's really done a great thing in your life. Tom's from Grand Rapids, Minnesota, and currently lives in Edina, Minnesota. For you in the nation, that's one of the nicer places to live. And he's with us tonight, so welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks, George and Billy. Sure appreciate the invitation and the opportunity to come back. And I do apologize for the Edina. I spend most of my life trying to beat up on them on the ice rink and so now I'm in the bubble. I have to apologize to my northern family.
Well, don't worry about that.
Did they shun you for that?
You know, it's funny. My two of my best friends growing up are now all in the bubble and as the last to migrate in. So it's kind of ironic, I guess.
Well, let's go with where you were raised. And what was your family like? How many people are in your family? Did you go to church? Tell us about it.
Yeah. Big Irish Catholic family, 11 children. My mom and dad, the Catholic Church, my mom was going to be a nun, and on their first date, they went to Mass together. So religion was a very big part of our family, and going to church not only every Sunday, but as a kid attending St. Joe's Elementary School, I went to class or church almost every day. So
daily Mass?
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you do altar boy stuff?
Oh, for sure.
Okay.
Yeah, I did a lot of weddings and a lot of funerals, and so it's...
Anytime a groom drop over?
No.
That happened to me a couple times.
Really?
Yeah. They're standing for so long, and they're stressed out, and they just faint and fall over.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it was great. I mean, I getting back to my childhood, it was, it was a different time, a simpler time, an easier time. George had mentioned, at lunch earlier, so many of us from Grand Rapids have done really well in business-wise. And I attribute that a lot to just we had great coaches, great parents, and great teachers.
Mm.
And so it really, I think of how, it's a blue-collar town and work ethic and so forth. But when you have those three things going for you and the strong faith that... it sets the course pretty well.
So your mom was going to be a nun and wound up having 11 kids.
Yeah, that's a swing for sure.
I know. Well, it shows God has his plan for us and we have ours. And you started out playing hockey at a very young age and you were pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, I was lucky. It's just like any other little brother. You just kind of follow your older brothers to the rink or the basketball court or the football field. And so for me and growing up, in Grand Rapids and kind of the fringe of there, and range hockey was kind of a big deal. And so from my oldest brother, Jim, who graduated in 72 when we beat Edina in the state tournament for the first time with the Craig Norwich era and to my brother John and Bill and myself and two younger brothers. And so, having a big family values, it just created a, you know, hockey was the game and kind of your source of identity, which later in life kind of worked against me, I guess.
So it's very interesting. One brother was captain of the University of Minnesota Duluth. The other brother was captain of Notre Dame, St. John's, Minnesota. And you were captain of hockey of the University of Minnesota Golden Gophers. Quite remarkable.
And it really is. You put it that way. There's a lot of leaders in that family and talent.
Yeah, I look at my dad and small town kid from North Dakota, little town outside of Henninger, and grew up on a farm and, you know, went to one of his only other, he had one other sibling that went to college, and so he was one of the lucky ones, but worked for Cargill and then started his own business, starting a finance company in Grand Rapids back in 1949, and then with 11 kids, by my time my oldest sister went to college at St. Scholastica in 68 or 9. He needed more income, so he started Rostein Realty. And so, that did very well as well. So we had kind of an entrepreneurial spirit. My mom's family owns a large construction company. And so out of the 11 kids, I think 8 of us own our own business.
Wow.
That really is amazing.
It's remarkable.
So growing up, you're playing hockey, guess you were probably a group leader in your class. You're going to mass a lot. Believe in God. When did you start drinking?
You know, I think I had my first beer or drink in 10th grade, but, you know, we were kind of ruled by an iron fist. And so, you know, there wasn't a lot of things you could get away with. It was easier being 9 than my oldest sister, who could get away with 0, because being the only child and the expectation level was quite high. We were able to get away with more as you fell down the food chain, but it was still pretty tough. So for me, when I went to the University of Minnesota and having the freedom, being the man of the house in my dorm, so to speak, the freedom to drink when I wanted, you know, my addiction just, it was immediate how I loved alcohol. I loved what it did for me. And how my relationship with God changed instantly. That it, you know, it was one to one with each drink I took. It was one step away from God, and just not knowing it.
So when you got off on your own, you took off, didn't you?
Oh yeah, that was. I thought heaven.
So there was a great story you told about your first report card and your father.
Yes, that was interesting. So, and thanks, George, for another highlight.
Leave it to George.
At the U of M, we were on quarters back then, and so my spring quarter, I only needed 3 classes, not 4, to meet the eligibility requirement for the NCAA, and so I thought no reason to take a full load if 3 classes just keeps me qualified. So it was Greek mythology, which was pretty high bar. And then you had, I think, biology and one other class, I can't remember, maybe Psych 101, which had 1,000 kids in the classroom. And so anyway, you know, it was easy to get lost because the size of these classes, and just with the spring and hockey being over, it was a good time to get outside and have fun. So I knew I didn't do great. Normally I'd get my report card sent to me at the dorm, but moving home in the summer and going back to work at the paper mill, my report card went to my dad's office at the loan company, and he called me and he said, could you swing by the office after work, which normally isn't a real positive situation. And so I'm like, something's up. And so I get there and he has my report card in his hands, and he shows me it and he goes, you know, looks like you got a C and 2 D's. What do you got to say for yourself? And with Billy and Johnny both playing college hockey and doing quite well in school, I knew I couldn't go down that road. So I paused for a second and I said, I know what you're thinking. I'm probably spending way too much time on that one class. I said, I really need to spread myself out. This is nuts. So I kind of slipped by, but the message was loud and clear. This won't continue.
I love that story. So when you went back the next year after working in the summer, did you buckle down a little bit?
you know, for sure, class is a little bit better. I kind of managed my independence a little bit more, but drinking was still, you know, an important part of it, and how it just, you know, certainly my relationship and my faith. I met my business partner at college. He was the same age playing football, and he was part of Fellowship of Christian Athletes. And so God put people in my life that I just kind of would bump into, but never stopped long enough to listen and see. I was really, you know, kind of hooked on the wagon of this addiction that just kept kind of getting more and more out of control, to the point where my education suffered, certainly my performance suffered. And so, you know, I like any addiction, it consumes everything, and you're willing to compromise everything to keep it going. And so certainly that was the path I was on.
Were you still going to Mass?
No. No, only when I was at home and had to show up.
Did you ever have the thought, hey, maybe I should reel this in a little bit?
Yeah, you know, I'd get us.
I never did, but maybe you did.
Yeah, no, you know, the courts will come in with the driving while drinking situation was clearly a message that this isn't a good thing. And being able to do that privately without exposing myself to my family and other people, you think you're getting away with it, which I think in life was kind of my MO, as I could just slide by. And what happens ultimately is the farther you slide by, the greater the fall is. And you almost wish when you slip the first time, it becomes a pretty big slip because you're forced to deal with the reality of it. And I just kept kind of sliding. And so I had my big fall, and it forced me to make some big changes.
So how did you make the big change?
You know, for me, it was really an intervention, and it's a tale of two stories. In 89, I had an intervention done on me by my family and three family members. So I went to St. Mary's, and step one resonates, because as I walked into St. Mary's, I just kind of broke down, and I kind of like the gigs up. You know, it was almost like the surrendering to God that I no longer can keep this charade going, and it's just over.
So St. Mary's is a treatment center in Minneapolis, or used to be.
Correct.
And you walked in, and all of a sudden the gig's over.
Yep.
So did you work pretty hard in treatment?
I did. I mean, I was, part of it is the relief that I no longer have to keep this charade going, and I'm just, you're over it. You kind of haven't come to full terms, like I'm never going to drink again, but the pressure's off and all this criticism. And so you're now looked in a different light, like, geez, look at this wonderful step Tom's taking. And so it felt good to be in a place where I'm now not being criticized, but being recognized for doing something constructive. I think what kept me sober is when my mom said to me during family week, you better not do this to your dad again. And so I think the Catholic guilt in that statement kept me sober for 20 years.
Tell us about that and your dad.
I think we're going to pick that up after the break, George. That's a great question, and I do want to hear about that, but we need to take a break. You are listening to Real Recovery, Bill and George, and Tom is our special guest. And we come back, we're going to find out what the answer to George's question is. We're listening to Real Recovery, Bill and George. George, right before the break, we were talking to our guest, Tom, about his relationship with his dad. You asked a very good question. Maybe you would ask him again if you remember the question.
Yeah, to recap a little, your mom said something to you when you were in rehab about your father. What was that?
Yeah, I just remember at lunch, and my dad had gotten up to get something, and she looked at me and just said, you better not do this to your father again. And, you know, which was kind of the way they looked at recovery, you know, like I was intentionally trying to hurt other people, and that I was doing this to them. And so having my strong Catholic faith and just my love for my dad and not wanting to disappoint your parents, just that just stuck with me. And it was extremely painful to hear, yet probably helped me stay sober for a number of years.
Did you feel like you let your dad down?
Oh, 100%. You know, I feel I left myself down. And I think, you know, what most people don't understand for people who are addicts and alcoholics is their greatest disappointment is themselves. You know, you disappoint all these other people and they look at you like, why does he continue to do this and hurt everybody? And the reality is, you know, it's the addiction doing the harm. It's just they have just succumbed to their addiction, and that doesn't play out in a very pretty way. You know, like a good friend of ours, Bob Bazan, says, you know, no one goes into treatment on a, you know, on a hot streak.
Yeah. Totally. You're not going in flying first class, are you?
No.
So what did you do to stay sober after you got out?
You know, I went to a couple AA meetings early on. I never got a sponsor. But I think I just liked the idea of feeling like I'm not disrespecting my parents. I'm respecting myself. And I'm not putting myself in a position of being embarrassed or put in jail or all the things that were the byproducts of my addiction. And so it was mostly just a willpower. I think I had a higher bottom than most. I hadn't kind of scorched the earth before I decided this was, you know, people decided to jump in and rescue me. So the transition to not drink wasn't as difficult. Where the problem happened was, again, I kind of, you know, like I say, I kind of dodged the bullet of real recovery. And in that, I stopped drinking, but I didn't rewire the network. And so I think my addictions played out in other ways. And so I became more selfish. Like, geez, if I'm not going to drink, then I'm entitled to this. I'm going to play more golf because I'm not drinking. I'm going to do this because I'm not drinking. And became, you know, just the addictions played off in other ways that were just completely unhealthy. And even my relationship, I did start going to church, but I wouldn't say I had a relationship as I did have a religion.
Were you happy?
You know, I think on some levels, yes, but on some levels I felt like I was not the person I was supposed to be and who God created.
But on the outside, it sure looked good.
Yeah, I had all the right pieces, married, children, great job, successful, good friends, good family. So I think a lot of pieces on, you know, looked really good on paper.
House on the lake, boat, golf clubs, a lot of friends, everybody loves you. Were you happy?
You know, I think on some level,
happy enough?
Yeah, you know, I think in the worldly things, yes. I think what it didn't prepare me for was the temptations of life that unprepared me where my addictions could play out. And so not reworking them and rewiring them and having a relationship with God to help remove them, thus step one, it left me vulnerable to fall, and I certainly did.
So what's really interesting to me, knowing the story, we get out of rehab. We go to a couple 12-step meetings. How long were you sober?
You know, 20 years.
Stunning.
Yeah.
That's a nice chunk of time.
That is stunning. Periodic, maybe twice a year, going to church, kids' baptisms.
Yeah.
And never a return. How did that change?
You know, I ended up having knee surgery in 2009. And having both of my knees replaced. And so I got put on pain medication. And so I started to take pain medication. And then I continued to take it at a time where the doctors prescribed it. And they really didn't limit how many you could have. And so I would take it for pain. Then I would take one like, well, I'm going out tonight with some friends and a couple. This is always nice to have that. Maybe my knee hurts a little, to the point where it was very frequent, wasn't really a mess in life, but just like clueless to what was going on until a friend of mine said, geez, you know, you got to get off those. I've had a friend of mine who worked for me, you know, die from that, which not being in a real recovery room and having a sponsor and other AA people that I'm engaged with, to give me that oversight, it just hit me sideways. Like, what do you mean? This, you know, the doctor's giving it to you. So I was, you know, just thought, geez, okay, I better stop. And so in 2011, I stopped taking them, only then to pick up a drink without really much hesitation. And so started drinking again, you know, once a month, once a week, twice a week, never probably more than three or four. But then my wife's like, now you're drinking? I'm like, oh, yeah, you know. And that was for about 2 years where the family decided to get together again and put me in the center of the room.
I like that. I drank a three or four, you know. Where does it become a problem when you get over 10?
I think that's the number. I mean, it really was. I think I was clearly on the path to, I mean, I think there was this, you know, and a good friend of ours, Michael McDermott, said, you know, once you know you're not supposed to be drinking, it takes a lot of fun out of it. And that clearly was the case.
So were you shocked at how quickly you went back? I mean, I can imagine after 20 years you could go, hey, you know, I'm not really an alcoholic. Look at what I've done. I was younger. I was in college.
Absolutely. All those trappings are playing out.
And then you go out. When was it you knew you were in trouble?
You know, I think deep down you always know, like, I'm not on the right path. You know, it's just like your faith. You know, you're either walking towards God or away from Him. And clearly, I was walking away from my recovery. And so, you know, there wasn't one big singular event or one, geez, I got totally blasted. It was just all of a sudden I woke up and they had an intervention at 8 o'clock in the morning. And it was like, wow. And yet, again, a similar surrender. Like, I knew I probably shouldn't be doing it. And so I'm just, someone else played the hand that I should have played.
So as part of that, I've talked to a lot of guys over the years, and they say, I knew I liked it too much. Was that part
100%.
Yeah.
From the first time I had it, I just knew it was, you know, I think all of us have, you know, we feel we're never good enough. You know, the whole A saying, we're always comparing our insides with other people's outsides, and that's just an unfair match. And so all those things I felt less than went away when I drank.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, how addicting and alluring that felt. So,
you know, I never knew you during that phase, Tom, but I've only known you to be charming and funny and enjoyable and generous. And there was never a part of me that thought, Tom needs some alcohol to have more fun. That never occurred to me.
Yeah, it's crazy. And I think part of that was growing up in that environment, you know. Back then, families would always have couples
sure.
over, and they'd play cards. And so it was always a family setting. You know, my mom and dad didn't go to the bar.
Mm-hmm.
And so sitting as a young child delivering, a Jim Beam and Coke or a Brandy Manhattan, you know, and just watching the people and the socialization part of it, I really romanticized about that.
Mm, interesting.
And so I think that is part of my dynamic, and I'm a very positive, love the energy of being in the middle of that. And so my attraction wasn't to the alcohol, but that was the theme of the deal.
Mm.
And so when I started drinking, I thought, oh, this is it. This is what I was looking forward to when I was 10. And the way I'm wired, you know, now the horse is out of the barn. Look up.
Wow.
You know, it's very interesting. I didn't know Tom when he drank, but what you said about him is true. And I always say our recovery has to be more fun than our using.
Mm-hmm.
With Tom, we've had to reel that in a few times, you know, in that I can't see you having more fun drinking.
I can't either.
It's impossible.
Yeah, it is amazing. And even my friends, I have a group of friends that have been with me since high school and even, you know, first grade elementary school and new friends I picked up along the way in college and when I was drinking and then a big group of friends who, you know, I hooked my wagon to in my recovery. And it's funny because they can't see me doing either one. You know, the ones that have never seen me drink always want to know, what was he like? You know what I mean? And
yeah.
So it is. It's what you find is George is spot on. The fact that you better have as much fun or you'll go back. And I love it. I was always a great Tom till midnight. And then Tom went off the cliff.
Mm-hmm.
And so to never have to go off the cliff is, you know, you go home feeling good about yourself.
Yeah. I do find it interesting, the environment growing up with your family. And I remember those cocktail parties or those parties that my friend's parents would have where there was this joyfulness going on and drinks yeah. being served. And they had a little bar kiosk in the, you know, in the living room
right.
somewhere.
Yeah.
And there was, it seems so fun,
yeah.
right?
There's just
totally.
But I'm 10. Yeah. What do I know?
Where you learn it is, if I want to ask my parents if I can sleep over at Larry's house as a kid, you wait till they get the liquor cart out, you know, with the ice thing and the tongs, and they have a couple, and the laughter starts.
Yeah.
And then you ask them, because the chances are yes is coming a lot more than before.
Yeah, true.
And you learn that, and then when you get that feeling, and you learn the feeling, you seek that feeling.
Yeah.
I fell off the cliff after midnight.
Yeah.
That's funny. So they have an intervention at 8 in the morning. Yeah. What, did you wake up and they're in your bedroom or what
happened?
They
were in the living room kind of waiting for me. And again, you know,
that's
11
not fair.
Of them. No.
Were you hungover?
Not really. I mean, I had come back from a weekend trip up north when I did drink. But again, didn't drink a lot, but just, you know, it wasn't, like I said, there was just no fun in it before you think you're having fun anyway, before you know you shouldn't be drinking. But once you've gone through treatment, there's just zero fun in your addiction. It's the escape and there's just no, boy, that was fun.
You know, the Bible talks about happy is the man that does not condemn anything he does. And if you've had some sobriety and you go back to using, you know you're not doing what you should be doing, and you condemn yourself, don't you?
Yeah, 100%.
You do. And so they had the intervention at 8 in the morning. This is great. I've never heard that. In the living room. Can I have some coffee first?
No, I know. And it's
so
just...
what did you wind up doing? Did you agree with them?
I did. You know, again, having all your family members there, you just kind of surrender.
Were your kids there?
Yep.
That had Doug.
That was really hard.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was tough. And so they had me set up to go to this treatment center down in Arizona called The Meadows. And so I got on a flight later that day and spent the next 30-some days down in Arizona at this treatment center.
How was that for you?
You know, it was a little bit like what just happened. Then I got kind of angry, like, you know.
No, really?
I know. Like, what is going on? I'm not that bad. And, you know, my wife put these people up to this. And
they overreacted.
Yeah, totally.
Of course they did.
Yeah.
And so really, really, really angry, almost to the point where, like, you know, I'm going to just leave, you know. And then I paused and I thought, you know, I have a daughter that has an addiction that is really going out of control. And if I can't stay here and deal with mine, how can I pray and ask for God to help her with hers? So she kind of kept me in there.
Can you see Rothstein in a bathrobe with a name tag and a cigar out of his mouth walking around the place?
Angry?
Yeah.
Totally. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to find out what God is doing in Tom's life today. We're listening to Real Recovery with Bill and George, and we'll be right back. We are back. You're listening to Real Recovery, Bill and George. Hey, I don't know if you've downloaded the Faith Radio app. Go to your app store and check it out. I have to say, it's a beautiful app. I've got mine on my iPhone. And when you download it, you just can't believe how pretty it is. And you open it up, and it's very easy to navigate your way through it. And you can listen to Faith Radio live, or you can just check out the podcast. It doesn't matter where you go. You can download if you've got that Faith Radio app. So give it a try. And if you don't like it, you know, it's easy just to delete it off your phone, but I'm pretty sure you'll keep it.
George, awesome episode tonight. Another award-winning episode, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. God.
All God.
All the time.
And our guest, Tom, has told quite a story. And George, we always say that God gives us a job to do. He gets us sober and gives us a job to do. And I know that Tom has had, he's been busy.
Yeah, as far as I know, how it started was two friends. One friend of his called a guy in recovery, and that started working with Tom. And what did you do, Tom, to make sure this time it stuck?
You know, it was exactly. I came back from Arizona. I did have a lot of momentum. I went to some meetings, didn't have a sponsor, which was critical. And my business partner was super instrumental. He had put putting Bill in my life and other times, and I just would have a nice lunch, but just kind of miss the point of the meeting. And so I knew Bill. I had a lot of respect for Bill. And he had reached out to Bill to say, geez, is there someone you could help Tom with in recovery? And that's when I think Billy reached out to you to be my sponsor, and which was the single biggest step in my recovery.
Oh, thank you. The only reason I worked with you is because you played golf at a certain country club, and I told you that because I was full, and you laughed.
I know.
But there were some requirements. We were going to go to the Big Blue Recovery Book Study and a Bible study and a support meeting and church, and you did all those willingly.
Yeah, I was. I was just kind of at that point where I was ready to go. Our connection with our hockey background, I think how we both see life, you and I like to laugh and like to look at the funny side of life and human nature playing itself out. And so you became someone I could relate to really well. My only impression of an AA meeting was back when I was 27 and everyone else in the room was 60 smoking cigarettes. So having you there, and then seeing other people my age in the meeting and even younger kids, it just gave me a whole new perspective on my recovery. And then, again, just kind of being naive to what it's going to take to be sober, having you just kind of lead me down the path and doing kind of a workbook approach to recovery, which is get a sponsor, go to meetings, work the steps, and go to church.
So it works if you work it. And whatever your plan is, you have to work at it and add to it. And Tom, you took off. People love you. I remember your daughter, we went out to eat one day, and I said to your daughter, I just love your dad. And she said, never forget this. Everyone says that about my father. And I thought, how great is that? That's the best. But you had some struggles when you got into recovery. Not yours, but a family member really struggled with addiction.
Yeah. I mean, it almost brings tears to my eyes thinking of that comment, because that was my daughter, Clara, who was just in her full-blown addiction and trying everything possible to help her and not knowing half the time if I'm helping or hurting and leaning on you for advice. And I just remember you always said, just keep her alive. Whatever you can do, to the point where she's going to bounce, and you don't know. I think for so many parents, family members, you know, I was one who was in recovery, fairly new, but knew the disease and the out of control part of this. But you're still a dad and a parent, and the love you have for this child, wanting to protect her from everything that, you know, is waiting there, and just seeing her keep taking steps closer and closer to that cliff, it just breaks your heart.
For me, excuse me, I get choked up too. Going back, this is a guy that's got the best connections, Billy, of anybody I know. This is a guy that has assets. This is a guy that's sober and is a God guy and is totally turned his life around, and he can't do anything about this. And I remember those, just do whatever you could to keep her alive. And we talk about if kids are a problem or a family member, you really can't do anything but pray. And, you know, do you toss them out of the house or not? I always say do what you can to live with, worst case scenario. And that, how did that turn out for you?
Yeah, it was. Today, I'm so happy to say that it's an absolute miracle, and only a picture God could paint. You know, where she is today, celebrating her third year of sobriety, 4 years actually, and her son just turning three, who's been an angel that. At the time, we thought, geez, her mom and I are going to end up raising this child for just her relatively new in recovery and just knowing how fragile those steps are. To see where she is today, I mean, part of the journey for me in walking alongside her was seeing what was available in the sober living space. And there wasn't a lot of sober home for women. It seemed like what was going on in that space wasn't, the bar wasn't set very high. You saw a huge degree of differences between, you know, one house to the next, very little, if any, regulation. And so part of that came out of the genesis of what is now called the Lion House, which is a house we purchased in St. Paul, not far from here, on Midway Parkway in Hamlet. And we, my partner and I, Pat Flanagan, purchased this home. And it's referred to by the Lion House because it has two lions out front. That was a very successful businessman from the 30s that built that home and had those in place. And anyway, you know, it's seven bedrooms, seven baths, and today now is probably the number one home for women and most sought after house for people coming out of recovery, whether it's from Hazelden or the retreat or other sober homes. So we purchased another home in St. Paul on Selby in Portland called Lion House Brownstone, which has a little bit more services tied around that and a family therapist component with a doctor that we've partnered with there. So, and Clara works closely with all of the girls, or several of them that are at our sober home, working as what they call a certified peer recovery person, which is basically a life coach. And I think it's probably the biggest game changer in recovery. You know, you spend thousands and tens of thousands of dollars to get sober. Yet I describe it kind of like going to Mayo and getting your cancer removed, and then they kind of put you in a car and say, when you get back to the cities, maybe try to find a good chemo or radiation doctor. And here, that's kind of what they do at treatment. They kind of kick you back out, try to stay in touch, stay involved, do some outpatient, but no one's really walking alongside of you. And what happens is when you stop, when you start drinking, your brain stops developing. And so they have kids that I might be 30 or women 35 years old that have the, you know, the brain of a 15-year-old. So they don't have any life skills that mm-hmm. we help them with.
Wow, that's remarkable. It really is. I mean, that's God putting something on your heart and you acting on it. That's fantastic.
Well, he thinks back when everybody's in his living room at 8 in the morning. I got to quit drinking. I've messed up. All things work together for good for those who love God and are walking according to his purpose. And what happens is you get sober. That helped your daughter get sober for sure. And you realize there's a need for people coming out of treatment. So you and Pat buy a house, redo it in a real nice fashion. And now you have two of them. And so what looked like it was a bad thing turned to good. It's so great to have you.
Yeah, no, it's just only God could have painted the picture for sure.
Yeah, well said, Tom. Thank you very, very much for coming back and being on the show once again, because your story is not only remarkable, but anointed by God, and the Holy Spirit has led you in through some rough waters, and now you're doing amazing work for the kingdom and for people in recovery. So it's awesome.
Yeah, thanks
great.
Again.
Thanks for the front row seat. Glad to see it. It was great.
Yeah, it was great. Thank you so much for listening to Real Recovery. You know, George and I love when you tune in because we love the stories of redemption. We love what God is doing in the lives of people trapped in addiction. And if that's you, we want you to find your way out. And you can do that through the power of Jesus in your life and also with community and finding yourself to a meeting or finding a church or someone that can come alongside you and help you, because that's why we're doing this show, to help you find Jesus Christ as your Savior and also to help you free yourself from the enslaving power of addiction. So, George, on that note, I think we'll say goodnight.
Okay, good night. Hey, Tommy, thanks for doing the show. It's always good to see you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you both.
You bet. That wraps up our show. Thank you very much for listening. Have a great week, and we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.